Hi, everyone. Welcome to the September edition of the Palisades podcast. We're so thrilled to be here yet again, social distancing in this beautiful studio at the Village Studios building in West LA. It's quite a striking building. I know Steve and I have talked about this before, but today, everybody go online and take a look at the pictures I'm going to post, because today we're in this amazing room that is our studio. Honestly, it looks like one of the most historic places I've seen in Los Angeles since I've been here. It looks like an opera house. This is really an amazing building. I know we talk about this a lot, but it's truly a little historic gem in the middle of the West Side, and it's a pleasure to be here today with none other than David Card. David Card is a Palisadian I hope you all know. At some point, we will rattle off all of his Palisadian bona fides. They're pretty impressive. He's been here since 1978, if I don't have that wrong. So he's been in the Palisades since 1978, and he's touched on almost everything important that happens in this town. So we're happy to welcome him today. I'm here with Steve Crone. Steve, how's it going?
Things are great. Glad to be here for our monthly sojourn into all things Palisades, and it's great to have Dave here with us. Dave is just starting his first period as chairman of the community council, although he has been chairman since the untimely passing of our mutual friend George Wolfberg. And Dave just won re-election unanimously. And so it'll be fun to talk about Dave's life, Dave's career, and the Palisades and what his incredible plans are for the future of the community council and the Palisades.
And beyond.
And beyond.
So this was the first Zoom voting in of a chair, was it not?
Yes, definitely the first.
Yeah,
that was not just the chair, but the whole council.
Yeah, but anything, exactly. So the PPCC has been meeting by Zoom now for a couple of months, which was really sort of a leading edge thing for community councils. I do want to give a nod to George Wolfberg. He was someone who was near and dear to my heart. Obviously, he was the chair of the community council years ago. I think it was 2000, I want to say 9. But when I sort of was VP and was asked to step up to chair, I went to George Wolfberg, with whom I had actually been refereeing at AYSO. Oddly enough, that's where I had met him, and we had formed a friendship. And I knew he was also on the community council because at the time he was the at-large rep. And quite an at-large rep he was. He really set the standard. So I went to George and I said, will you be the vice chair? And he said, oh, no, I've been there, done that. I'm too old for this. And I was like, yeah, but I can't do this without you. Will you please step in and be what vice chair? And he and Chris became, you know, my two crutches, and they were wonderful. And George was someone who was near and dear to my heart. I really adored him. So then when I left, obviously, he became chair. And I just want to sort of acknowledge his untimely passing. I want to sort of congratulate the Palisades, this entire city of Los Angeles, for being able to name the Potrero Canyon Park after him. I think that was a big win, and thanks to Bonin for supporting that. And then just congratulations to you at the time. I know you've been friends for a long, long time. You were a trusted advisor to him for a long time. Then he named you as vice chair in the middle of his term, and I'm just, you know, kind of glad that we get to talk to you, and, you know, we get to touch on the life of George, too, for a second.
Right. I sort of fell into all the successive jobs that I've had on the council, from being a Rotary rep to an American Legion rep to being at large alternate to at large and then finally to vice chair and then chair, all sort of by accident. But I think George had a hand in a lot of it by maybe steering it along, because he and I have had a wonderful working relationship ever since I sat next to him for all those 2 or 3 years of hearings on the Potrero Canyon way back in the middle of the 2000s. And so we developed a great working relationship, and he was my mentor all along, and I really appreciate him and miss him.
I think we all do.
Yeah. So that Potrero Canyon, I mean, we'll go back in time. This is not a chronological conversation, but Potrero Canyon for a second. Dave, walk us through that process, because that project has been ongoing for, I want to say, more than a decade. It's had so many twists and turns. There have been times where it's kind of plugged along on the side. There have been times when it's been a big part of the Palisades narrative. You know, there have been auctions. There have been issues. There have been truly a project for all time. So tell us where it started and how did we get to where we are now, which is probably pretty close to inception.
Well, My first experience with it was in junior high when I had the Santa Monica Evening Outlook route that went along Friend Street, among other streets, that is on the west rim of the canyon, Potrero Canyon. And during that time, I also, as part of my route in 1957 or 8, I was eyewitness to that huge, huge landslide that slipped down from Via de los Olos, covered a worker who was buried alive and didn't succeed in surviving the huge landslide. Went over the highway, went over the beach, and went into the ocean. That's why PCH makes that big loop around the landslide. My next experience with it was...
Wait, stop one second. PCH makes a loop around...
Around the landslide.
A site that used to be a landslide? Interesting.
Right.
Okay.
That whole bowl of Via de los Olos sloughed down 2 or 3 football fields worth of land, and one piece slid down into the ocean. And so PCH right away goes under the landslide for the old PCH. They instead of excavating, they decided to go around it. Mm-hmm. So they built the highway into the ocean and created a new beach. Second experience with it was in landscape architecture school. And that's when my senior thesis was Potrero Canyon. And my big concept was to build design a arts Chautauqua.
Oh, wow.
Because the Palisades is known for historic Chautauquas. And I thought a tent camp in Potrero Canyon with a big lodge down overlooking the ocean, but tent camps all the way up and trails. And then, of course, to make it even more of a student extreme idea, we would go over PCH with a land bridge and a
which
tunnel.
Which we're still trying to get.
And a tunnel under, we're still trying to get a bridge, but this would be a land bridge, and PCH would become a tunnel, and then you'd walk out onto a serpentine-shaped pier that would be a historic reference to the Long Wharf that was there,
right,
that one of the Huntingtons wanted to make the port of L.A.
Right.
unsuccessfully.
Amazing. Where did you go to school at that point, and why was Potrero Canyon on your radar?
I didn't just start in 78 in the Palisades. My parents moved from 23rd and Carlisle in Santa Monica to Toyopa, 535 Toyopa, when I started junior high at Paul Revere in seventh grade. So from seventh grade through college, I grew up in the Palisades when there were still vacant lots that the kids could play in. And so we had our little gang on the block, and I went through Paul Revere. Then I went for 10th grade to Uni High because Pali High was being built then. So for 11th and 12th grade, we opened Pali High. So
Pali.
I was in the first graduating class
of
at
64.
Pali High. Class of 63.
63.
Summer of 63.
2 years before the famous class of 65.
Yes.
About which books
yes.
have been written.
So I cannot imagine what a different Palisades, even what a different Santa Monica you're talking about. I mean, your parents moving from Carlisle and...
23rd and Carlisle.
And 23rd. I mean, that must have been flat land that wasn't developed at all. And then coming up here to the Huntington, what a different Palisades.
Well, it was a middle class, but an upper middle class neighborhood then, not the way it is now, but it was a lot more middle class and professionals and engineers and, you know, mid-level workers, employees.
What were the alphabet streets like then? Were they sort of bare still? Was it just hillside?
Well, my one rival for my girlfriend, now my wife at the time in high school, was a guy who lived on the alphabet streets whose family had their pickup trucks on their front lawn, and they would work on their pickup trucks in their front lawn. So
you've got to be kidding.
This guy was my rival. And when I was on the football team, so when we would always butt heads across the line. So
literally and figuratively.
Literally, yes. And I thought we were going to get a fight one time when I cut in on them dancing together at a in Mercer Hall, what's now Mercer Hall, on campus.
Wow. Just quickly, since I have kids at Pali High, and it is a school that is bustling with people, it brings in kids from across Los Angeles. We roughly say 100 different zip codes. It's got 3,000 kids. You know, I talk to the principal not uncommonly, and, you know, it's a huge task administering that school. What was it like in the first couple of years when it was started?
It wasn't very populated. We had we started with 10th and 11th graders, no 12th graders, because none of the seniors would have wanted to move
to a brand new school,
you know, in their senior year. So we only had two grade levels, and it was sparsely populated. Everybody had a class. Everybody had a locker.
Did everybody
know
each
other? We get to establish the tradition. When I was still at Uni High, they had a contest for what to name the mascot for Pali High. And my mom and I came up with the Dolphins, and we won.
That's incredible.
We got zero. You're responsible?
Yeah.
You and your mom?
Yeah.
That is incredible. This is a piece of Palisades history right here.
Yeah.
It's incredible. So Uni High, I know you want to move on from education, but Uni High, there again, talk about the evolution of a school. I get the feeling that back in the 60s, Uni High was the place to want to go.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
because it drew from Brentwood. It drew from all the way into the Palisades. It was it was from the more well-to-do West Side, but also it drew from all over. So it was a very mixed, diverse student body.
So it's now a Title I school. Mm-hmm. So talk about the evolution of a school. Mm-hmm. It is now, you know, a school that largely has underserved kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a historic building. I don't know if you remember the building, but it's a beautiful building.
I've been there recently recruiting for Boys State and so on.
Oh, cool. All right, yeah.
So I'd love to hear about your whole early life, but there's a lot of things I also want to talk to you about. So quickly, you went from Pali to Stanford?
Right.
Right away?
Right away.
And then shortly after Stanford, you enlisted?
Well, no. My whole senior year, this is way before the draft lottery. There was the old draft where there was a Westwood draft board. And so the Westwood draft board was getting lots of student deferments. And so they were looking for live bodies. So I had no grounds for a deferment. And so I passed my Army physical. And they said, well, you can finish your senior year at Stanford, but as soon as you're done, you're ours. The Army wants you. And my father-in-law-to-be knew somebody who got me into Navy Officer Candidate School back in Newport, Rhode Island. It's the only place they train officers outside of Annapolis Military Academy. And so over 4 months, I arrived in summer. I drove cross country with my friend Rick from my fraternity. He was going to Penn to go to medical school. I kept going on. And in the summer, September, I started at Navy OCS. And Rhode Island's a beautiful, beautiful state. It's all waterfront. Everything's waterfront. And my uncle grew up there and is a big sailor. It was also during the America's Cup. So I got to see some of the America's Cup 12-meter sloops when they were tied up at the dock and before I had to report. My military, the academics in Officer Candidate School were easy, but and sort of interesting, but my military attitude was wanting. So I ended up on suspension with too many red gigs, but I passed and graduated. And as soon as I graduated, I flew home and got married two or three days later in my wife's family backyard with a big tent and lots of and a big, huge display of forsythia, yellow blooming forsythia. Okay. And that was fun. And then
that had to be in the Palisades, right?
That was in Brentwood, on North Carmelina, north of Sunset.
And while you were in the Navy, you voted for the first time?
Yes.
And
well, wait a minute. Let me just tell you one quick story.
Okay,
because everybody in OCS wanted to be either a destroyer so they could move up the chain of command with promotions quickly and be in charge on a small ship. And the other people wanted to hide on a big aircraft carrier. And I didn't want either of those because I didn't want to go up the chain of command and be promoted. This was not my career, and I didn't want the all the spit and polish with all the admirals on board an aircraft carrier, and because that's not me. And so I remembered the old play and famous movie Mr. Roberts with James Cagney, Jack Lemmon, and Henry Fonda about World War II tub of that was James Cagney wanted to keep out of World War II, and Henry Fonda wanted to get into the action, and Jack Lemmon was the comic relief, and I wanted that old tub of a cargo ship, so I got it because nobody else wanted it.
Wow.
And so I got a World War II vintage USS Seminole, commissioned just in 1945, before the end of the war. It had Marine Corps cargo on board, supporting amphibious landings. It had landing craft on the top of the holds so that we could land the material on the beaches, and we'd practice on the beach in along the Strand just below the Del Coronado Hotel in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And usually it'd be dense fog, and we'd only have our radio, and I got to be the commanding officer of a landing craft.
Wow.
Me and my helmsman. And we usually find the beach somehow.
Wow. And now when you drive by, do all those memories come rushing back?
Sure, sure.
And I can't imagine the equipment you had then versus what the Navy has now.
No, since then, a few years ago, they had, right now it's Navy Days in Port of L.A., but they're doing it virtually. But they had it actual, and we got to go into one of the modern amphibious ships.
Wow.
And it was just is incredible. And there were a couple of Marines on board in the hold allowing you to hold one of their top-of-the-line military-issue automatic guns. And my wife, I have a picture of her holding one of these things. Huh. They wouldn't let us shoot it, but...
that's a good thing.
So in my mind, you're kind of a contradiction in terms on this,
yes,
this area.
And you were getting to the voting.
Yeah. So you went into the Navy because you didn't want to go into the Army, and I assume you didn't want to go fight in the jungles of Vietnam.
Right.
So you go into the Navy, you finish, you get out of there. I assume you're admiral. What's the word?
I went in as an ensign, and I came out as a lieutenant junior grade.
So you did well.
Well enough.
You voted in the 68 election.
That's right.
And then for someone who went into the military reluctantly, you're still involved in the American Legion.
Yes.
Is there a contradiction there?
No, because the reason it took me a long time to come to terms with being comfortable with my military service. Mm-hmm. So I didn't want to join the American Legion for a long time. But with all the current, last decade or more of wars overseas and all the veterans coming back and not getting the support they deserve, I figured I should belong to the American Legion Post because they serve the veterans of Southern California and beyond, and they have the resources to do that. So
really
I figured
do support
I
them.
Could do that.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay, so before we move on, who'd you vote for in the 1968 presidential election?
Well, you remember 68 was an unusual year for politics. We had
yes.
the Chicago Democratic Convention with Tom Hayden versus the Daley's police force in the streets, and highly contested nomination process. Hubert Humphrey got the nomination. As long as he was vice president, he would not pledge to end the war in Vietnam. And Nixon did pledge to end the war. He had the secret plan, and I did not believe him at all. And so I voted third party. And the only party that was on the ballot that favored an end to the Vietnam War was the Peace and Freedom Party, whose candidate was Eldridge Cleaver. And I had already read Eldridge Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, about his prison experiences and being a black man in America. So that was my vote. And I was proud of it.
Maybe the only military person in history that voted for Eldridge Cleaver. I don't know.
Exactly.
Maybe
but
not.
But. I told my men, though, that they have a duty to vote. And I said, I don't care who you vote for, just vote, please.
Wow.
What an amazing story.
All right. So then you come back and did you go to law school right away? After?
Yeah. Well, for about 6 or 9 months, I worked as just a clerk, and not a law clerk, but a clerk at a downtown law firm.
And where did you go to law school?
I went to start at USC Law School.
USC, okay.
Right.
Okay.
And when They had just had a big turnover of professors. The old guys were fading out. The new guys were coming in, and they had all kinds of new ideas about how to teach the law. So it was fun.
And this was what year?
1970.
Yeah, so early 70s. You
guys, that's the year I started too.
Mm-hmm. Law school?
Yeah, we started in the same year, but difference is he had a few years in the Navy and I got out of the draft in other ways.
And where did you go to law school?
Hastings.
So you guys, I want to say, okay, so caveat, 1968, I don't have much of a memory of, and even if I did, I would be across the globe. So I want to ask you two, it sounds like it was really a revolutionary time here in the States.
Very revolutionary time.
Most not disruptive, in a violent way, but in an ideological way.
It was the, I can't remember if that was the year that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated.
It was.
And also,
Bobby Kennedy.
I was in the Navy, going to bed. We had just watched the California primary, Democratic primary, and turned it off. Kennedy had won. And then I set my clock radio for getting up, and they said, Bobby Kennedy's been assassinated. So we turned back on the TV, and I got very little sleep that night. But that was really astonishing and traumatic.
Yeah. That year was incredible because King being assassinated, Kennedy being assassinated, then the nomination kind of fell by default to Humphrey, and then there were the riots in Chicago, and Nixon got elected, and I mean it was an incredibly
and then the
dramatic
war continued for another 5 years.
Yeah,
or so.
All the secret plans didn't come about.
So I want to stay on this for a second because I think it's just historically significant. And I feel like in America right now, we're again in a time that's kind of volatile. It's, you know, ideas are far apart and it feels like it is a little bit of a time for, I come from a country that actually had a revolution, so I don't like to use that word, but we are in a time of revolutionary ideas, right? Out of the box ideas that are getting some airtime. You were talking about when you started law school, it was this moment where sort of the older guard was moving on and new people were coming in with new ideas about the law and how to teach it. What do you mean by that, and what was that like? I assume that is the trend that we've lived under for the last 40 or 50 years.
One of my professors for a new course, a new concept of a first-year law student course, was called Law, Language, and Ethics, taught by Christopher Stone, who is the son of the highly liberal, very liberal publisher and thinker. I forget, but his father's name was Stone. And so Chris Stone has his own ideas about the law, and he wrote a book called Do Trees Have Standing? And so we discussed that one day in freshman, first year law, 1L.
I have that.
And
Do Trees Have Standing? That was
interesting. And we also had Professor Lefko, who I think is still there. Mm-hmm. I think Stone is still there. And Professor Lefko was taught real property law, and he was a wonderful professor. I really love them. Most of them are young, just starting out their careers.
It's hard for me, as one who went through law school, to imagine a wonderful real property instructor, because I found it and my career went obviously different directions than yours, but my legal career, but I found it the most boring, tedious.
You're kidding. I loved real property
subject
law.
Ever.
And I still remember. So I actually transferred, not to harp on this too long, but I transferred law schools. We lived in New York. I went to a very liberal law school, and then I was married at the time. We decided to move to California. I ended up in a very conservative law school. That's actually where I graduated from. And it was crazy for me to see the difference that ideology can produce in teaching law. I would never have thought. But yeah, my real property professor was actually a gem from Michigan, and he taught me about riparian rights, which is why some of the stuff at Prochero makes sense to me.
Right. Well, it was a breath of fresh air for me coming from the Navy and its very highly structured military life to the freedom of the give and take of a law school class. And I was married and thrilled to be there. And unlike some of my classmates who didn't know what they were going to do or why they were there and didn't like it.
I can imagine that you really did enjoy delving into the concepts that you could sort of, you know, reach into and right. consider throughout law school.
Yeah, just going back one more time to the military, the things I remember about the military are the responsibility that they give somebody mm-hmm. so young. Because I was like 22, 23, and here I was, officer of the deck in charge of 300 men on a big cargo ship. And I would be on the bridge making sure that we were headed in the right direction and that we weren't going to crash into anybody on the open seas. But it's so glorious to be in the open sea, to see the sunrises, the sunsets, I had the con, which means control of the bridge, coming out of Tokyo Harbor one time in a very gentle snowfall, no wind, and it was so beautiful. And of course, the captain, the commanding officer, a four-striper captain, is looking over my shoulder, as is the pilot who knows that bay. And we were just zigzagging through all the ships at anchor.
Amazing.
And it was so gorgeous. And then refueling at sea. That is a huge responsibility because the oil tanker just keeps going straight. You have to adjust to it.
Wow.
And you have these huge oil hose lines that are 6 to 9 inches in diameter, and if they snap, they could snap back and kill somebody on deck. So you had to maintain the proper distance, and that was a big responsibility.
Are there bumpers involved? I mean, can you crash?
We had bumpers over the side, but we never got
Sounds
that
tricky.
Close. But we once in a while had to transfer people between ships that are steaming full steam.
Wow.
That was interesting.
Dave, you think it's the same now? I mean, so you're saying you were a young man, you enlisted in the Navy, and you were able to be in a position of great responsibility. But at the same time, sort of by the same token as we're talking about the way the Palisades has changed, has serving in the military changed? Do you think that today, when a kid, you know, walks in and signs up to serve in the military, do they walk into the same set of opportunities, or
I think the opportunities are a lot greater now because you have to be better educated and you have to learn more skills to be in the Navy now or any of the military services. You have to know computers. We didn't have computers then.
Yeah.
We had radios, stacks of radios. Yeah. But you have to be smarter and better educated now. And I did get a chance to see during the Navy days a few years ago, we positioned, my wife and I stood in the bridge of that big amphibious, one of the big amphibious ships, and coming into dock to get refueled, or at least to practice coming into dock. Mm. And the officer of the deck was a young woman.
Oh, wow.
Who would have been, she was an ensign, a green ensign, and she was in charge. But, of course, she had a pilot and the captain looking over his shoulder, but she looked in control and in command and
amazing.
Knew what she was doing. And I was very
proud
to see
that. That probably would not have happened in your day.
Never.
Very cool.
Okay, so in looking at the little resume you sent us, it struck me that in broad terms, you've had two entirely separate careers.
Yes.
Right? Law school.
Right.
And then you went to UCLA and got in their landscape design program and finished that. So
Right. Let's,
if you will, talk for a few minutes about your law career, what you did, where, why, and what made you decide to switch in mid-career.
Well, I had about 25 to 30 years as a lawyer, worked very briefly for a law firm in Westwood, then got a job at Security Pacific National Bank's legal department, specializing in the little subgroup of the legal department that had special assets department as a client. Special assets department was the commercial and corporate loans that were a problem. They weren't paying, or they were having problems, or they anticipated that they would have problems, or their loan needed to be restructured because we had confidence in the borrower, we could do that sort of thing and restructure. We also had borrowers who were not so in the up and up, who were defrauding the bank. So we'd go after those folks. Or if they were just not good managers of their business and they didn't know what they were doing and they were running it in the ground and our loan was in jeopardy, we would sometimes have to call the loan and not restructure, but call the loan and collect. And we did some of that. We would hire outside law firms to do the collection litigation. We would hire outside law firms to do bankruptcies, but sometimes we got to do them ourselves. I did some law and motion work in court, which is always nice to get out from behind the desk and do some, get into courtroom and see how trial lawyers work and how the judges work, and get a sense of the judge before you had to go up and argue your motion. And that was always fun. And I always remembered the one rule we learned in law school: if you're winning in front of the judge, shut up and sit down.
Oh yeah.
So we learned that. And we had some interesting cases. We had my first bankruptcy that I worked on was Marshburn Farms, a carrot farmer in San Bernardino County, and he just had bad luck. The horrible rains couldn't harvest the carrots. Mm-hmm. So he had to file bankruptcy. Unfortunately, I went to the first hearing with the credit officer, and unfortunately the borrower rolls up in a brand new pink Cadillac with Marshburn Farms stencil sign on the side of the door. And
not much
the
sympathy
credit
there.
Officer went berserk, and we had to pull him off the ceiling to, yes, we should settle this case, and yeah, this is how we need to handle this. We don't need to blow it all up because of that.
Very funny.
So you did you enjoy your practice as a
yes,
lawyer?
Yes, I enjoyed doing those kinds of loans because everyone was different. Every problem loan was different, and it wasn't just churning out new borrowing documents for new loans. It was trying to solve a problem.
Yeah, and whether solving problems.
And sometimes, you know, there was the shrimp importer who defrauded us and was selling the inventory without accounting for the receivables and his collections. And so I was able to go into bankruptcy court and get his debt declared non-dischargeable so that he would still owe us the money after he got out of bankruptcy. So that was one case where I actually won a non-dischargeability in bankruptcy court. I worked on the Orange County's bankruptcy when Chapter 9, rarely used, but during that period of time, when the markets collapsed, and because of the high dividend, the high yield bonds collapsed, Orange County couldn't keep paying its employees, even though it declared Chapter 9. Mm. Chapter 9 is a restructure. Because as a county, you have a tax base, you still collect taxes. So it's basically a court-structured restructure.
Wow.
And all the guys in the legal department in my group wanted to represent the county. And I was given the third choice, and I got to represent the trust department. Mm-hmm. Turns out the trust department was a creditor of the county, and I got to accompany my trust officer who knew nothing, and I would tell him everything he needed to know and what to do in all the creditors committee meetings and help and guide the restructure of the county. I didn't do anything, but at least it was fun because I could be sitting in court and seeing the top bankruptcy lawyers in the country argue for and against all the issues that came up in that case.
Dave, what year was that?
I don't know. But, 80s, I guess, 90s.
Orange County did pretty well following that restructuring.
Yes.
Kudos.
Because they have a tax base.
Right.
They get revenue.
Right. They have a pretty good tax base, actually.
Yes.
So how many years did you practice law?
Almost 30. Oh.
And then?
But towards the end of that, I realized they don't have too many old lawyers in the bank's legal department. And they have a habit of letting the people go who have a little bit higher salaries. Nobody was paying us a ton of money, but a little bit higher salaries who had been there for a while, make room for younger and less salaried people. So I knew I wanted to switch careers to landscape architecture, and that's what I did. I went to UCLA Extension, had a very established and well-known landscape architecture program. It was night school and weekends. So it was a four-year program then, and I did all 4 years while I was working for the bank.
That's incredible.
Pardon? Do you have kids?
Oh, yeah, two boys.
And you were raising them, working full-time and going to class
By the time I was going to landscape architecture school, they had already left the nest, although somewhat still dependent. Mm-hmm.
Because the reason I ask is because I had a similar epiphany, and I started the UCLA Landscape Architecture program.
Really?
I took like 3 classes. I really liked it. And then I just looked around and I said, I had 3 little kids. I said, I got to be working. I don't have time to, you know, work full time, see the kids at night, and go to class at night. And so with a great deal of reservation after, I think, my 3rd class, I really liked them. I did well in the classes and was encouraged by the professors to go on. And I just said, I can't manage it all. It was just too much stuff. So I dropped out. But
that's amazing that you guys have landscape architecture in common. Maybe
yeah.
there's a theme there. What drew you?
I'm Dave, envious that you got to finish.
But you had quite a career in defense
law. I had a great
law.
Career, but, you know, yeah. I was looking for a different career. At some
Dave,
point.
What
right.
drew you to, I mean,
well, my
you know,
father
one cannot
loved
naturally see
yeah.
the connection between yeah. the Navy, corporate law, and, you know,
no
something
connection
is,
at all.
No
yeah.
connection. My father loved to garden, so we'd always, as boys, help him in the garden, my brother and I. And then both my Uncle John in Santa Monica grew orchids in his greenhouse, and I loved those. And my wife's father had his orchid greenhouse, and I loved those. So I figured, you know, when I get my first house, which we finally did on Joffrey Street in what they now call Brentwood Glen, but my dad knew was best friends with Al Rattery, whose family developed that tract between Church Lane and the VA and south of Sunset and the 405. So we had a starter house there, and I designed my front and backyard garden, and nice. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
And you ended up having a really successful career doing that.
I had fun.
And the connection to the Palisades is actually huge within
yeah.
landscape architecture, right? I mean, there's an atoll in the Palisades you probably don't know at this point. There was the Rustic Canyon Recreation Center. There was the Palisades Malibu YMCA. You designed the Simon Meadow property?
Right.
That's
right.
impressive.
Potrero,
yeah, I'll have you talk about that because that's a gem in the Palisades. The Potrero Canyon Community Advisory Committee, you were the lead designer.
Yes.
And I'd love for you to talk about that riparian way because I think that's a stroke of genius. And then the pump station, the famous Bureau of Sanitation station on the corner of PCH and Temescal. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a bit of Palisades. Then there's the Northfield Triangle. The San Lorenzo Street Residence, there was one on that street. DePauw Street Residence must have been interesting. Commonwealth Avenue Residence, Enchanted Way Residence, and the Parish of St. Matthews. Tell us a little bit about that.
Both our boys were going to St. Matthews, and the church burned down in the 78 fire, and the old A-frame, and so we needed to build a new one. So I volunteered to help with the building committee, and since I was the only lawyer on the building committee, I got to draft all the contracts and negotiate them with the architect, with the contractor, and some of the subs. And we got to, nobody wanted to volunteer to be the interior design subcommittee chair. Mm. So I figured, hey, our minister, Father Fenton, said, church isn't the building. The church is what goes on in the people inside the building. And so I figured, oh, interior design of a church, that is what will make it a church and not just a barn. Mm-hmm. And so that was really fun working with Moore Rubel Udell when Charles Moore was still alive, very famous architect and one of the fathers of postmodernism. Yeah. And so to get to work with him and see him do his sketch on it, freehand sketches of his ideas put to paper as we were talking about the ideas around the table.
Incredible.
That was really exciting.
Well, and there was no AutoCAD back then,
no.
So they were drawing by hand. And I have to say that is an exceptionally mm-hmm. beautiful building and mm-hmm. a striking church.
Right.
Kind of, you know, modern but timeless.
Right. And
everyone to go take a look at it. That was quite a project.
Because of the politics in the church, we were required to have the design approved by 60% of the parishioners voting.
Wow.
So we did lots of workshops with the parishioners on design ideas. The Moore Rubel Udell would show slides of different kinds of styles of buildings. Do you like this style, that style? And you'd write that down. And then we'd have a workshop where we'd get Cheerios and other things and do our own design of what the church outline, you know, foundation and rooftop should look like.
Amazing.
So it turns out that what people wanted, they wanted a semicircle so everybody could be up close, mm-hmm. but they wanted a cruciform roof line. So that's what it has.
Amazing. So that was probably good practice for the community council mm-hmm. where you have to do these, you know, community workshops and get consensus.
Yeah.
Now, you had a certificate in landscape architecture, but it sounds to me like when you were dealing at least with St. Matthew's and maybe some of these other projects, you were going beyond landscape. You were it sounded like you were dealing with the building architecture as well.
Building architecture, interior design, and the landscaping also.
Now, did you have to have a license for that,
no.
or was there a license?
No,
was
I'm
there a
just
license?
A volunteer on the building committee.
I see.
And then once the designs were voted on and complete, then I was on the executive committee and to oversee the implementation and construction.
So you were using your landscape architecture background, but you weren't the architect for that?
No, I hadn't gone to landscape architecture school then. It was just something that I was interested in. And it was fun working with the artists as well, the artists who did the woodwork on the altar, the artists that did the stained glass windows, the architects who did the designs of the doors and the lighting, that sort of thing. That was fun.
So you finish your four-year program, and then what do? Do you just hang out a shingle and say, I'm a landscape
no.
architect, I hope you'll come to see me, or did you work for somebody? Or
I wish it was that simple. No, I stayed as long as I could at what was then Bank of America, and they were all looking to downsize. And so I was given, when I left Security Pacific Bank, I was laid off and got a severance pay. And then 9 or 10 years later, I was laid off again at Bank of America as I was going to landscape architecture school and got a second severance. So I ended up getting two severance pays from the two banks I worked for, which helped to when I got started. And I went to work for one of my professors out in Corona. He had his own practice out in Corona in Riverside County. So imagine I had to sell my love of my life, my Ford 150 pickup truck. I had to sell it for a Toyota, gas electric combo one, the
Prius.
Yeah, I had to get a Prius, and so I could get into the Diamond Lane to do the hour and a half commute each way to Corona and back. And so I did that for about 3 years. And then I hung out my shingle and worked from home from then on.
And that brings us to the modern day, because certainly there was no Prius back in the day.
No, we are catching up.
We are.
Probably had a computer by then.
Yes, had a computer. And I did AutoCAD work at the landscape architecture firm, but not very well. And that was the hardest class in landscape architecture school for me, is learning AutoCAD.
Yeah, transitioning from the mm-hmm. human hand.
Yeah.
To...
And so ever since I didn't have to do that anymore, I've always drawn by hand.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I've noticed in our community council Zoom meetings, you know, you get little windows of people, and you're always sitting at what looks like a desk, and behind you there's all these plans that are rolled up. My dad was a builder and a contractor, so I grew up with those plans all around the house, too. I forgot what they used to copy, some kind of a blue thing that would duplicate these large-scale plans.
Yeah.
So we had those all
blueprints.
Over the house. Blueprints, thank you.
Yeah.
With the ammonia smell.
Yes, yeah. And so when I've seen you in Zoom meetings, you think we're looking at you. I'm looking at all the plans in the background.
And if you look really closely, you can see... I have a whole series of N.C. Wyeth posters in my office.
Of what?
N.C. Wyeth, Andrew Wyeth's father, uh-huh. who's a famous illustrator. And so I have in the background, if you look closely, if I move my head enough, you can see the book cover of that N.C. Wyeth did of Treasure Island. And I have others of Robin Hood coming out of the forest. And so it's a... He's a famous illustrator. It's fun.
Your office is actually really cool. Your office is kind of like this room. It's a piece of history.
Well, it's my wife would call it a mess. But,
but we'll call it a piece of history. So I want to take you back to your activist days. So Steve Krohn, are we allowed to talk politics on this podcast?
Absolutely. Okay. We've done it before, of course.
We've done it before? We'll do it again. I just want to take you back to your activist days for a while. So, you know, again, sort of in the 60s, and you can both talk about this, things were changing. People were thinking. People were kind of envisioning what the rest of, you know, what America was going to look like as it kind of stepped into the future. And I feel like it was another time when, you know, the differences between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party were kind of crystallizing. And I think, if I don't recall incorrectly, you and I had a conversation about you having some pretty clear-eyed ideas about what direction this nation should go in and put some sweat and toil into those beliefs, yeah?
Yeah, a little bit. Growing up, my parents were always and evermore were rock-ribbed Republicans, loved Nixon, loved Reagan, loved all of it. And so my freshman year at Stanford, I was a Rockefeller Republican in the Young Republicans Club. That didn't last long. And then as the Vietnam War geared up, I became way more liberal and very anti-war. And after my experience in Hong Kong as well, much more liberal. And I even marched one of those huge marches in San Francisco from the wharfs all the way to the end of Golden Gate Park, I think it was. Wow. And then after voting for Eldridge Cleaver, I've been a Democrat ever since.
Yeah.
And after the experience of 9/11 and the Bush years, I really wanted to work for change.
Yeah.
I said, no, you know, when Bush got reelected, George W., I really wanted to elect somebody on the far liberal side. So early on, I noticed, as many others did, that Barack Obama was an up-and-comer. And I wormed my way into the very first Camp Obama organizing a training camp out in the valley in one of the electrical union buildings, and got a huge training in how to be a grassroots organizer.
Oh, wow.
And some of the people that worked side by side with Cesar Chavez and knew what they were talking about in grassroots organizing. So we did practice things like learn how to give your story in the 2-minute elevator pitch when you're knocking on doors talking to people or anybody. And you need to give your experience and then ask them for their experience and how do you feel, you know, all of that training on how to be grassroots and how to do it early, do it often, network as much as you can, all of that training. That was very interesting. And so I put it to work in, we did tabling. The Obama grassroots group did tabling at the Palisades Farmers Market. And, you know, I'd have either a TV tray or a little coffee table of some sort, card table, and we'd do work that. We'd also...
So you'd actually invite people to come sit down at your coffee table and chat?
Sure.
Oh,
yeah.
Cool.
It was mostly standing up, but yeah. And that's also... It was a stepping stone from what my wife did 4 years earlier. She worked for Kerry, for president, back in New Hampshire. She, at Thanksgiving, she said... Bye-bye, Dave. Before
Amazing.
Thanksgiving, I'm going to work in New Hampshire for Kerry. Or, no, it wasn't Kerry. She was working for General Clark.
Wesley Clark.
So we thought that he was liberal enough, but also presidential enough
and
experienced enough.
Yeah,
that he would make a good president. So
I did too.
Wesley Clark. And so she worked for him and left me all by myself.
But that campaign, as I recall, did not get much traction.
Didn't get much traction.
To the surprise of a lot of people.
Yeah. As soon as he came in third, I think, or maybe worse in New Hampshire, it just went nowhere. So
can you guys remind me, is New Hampshire a swing state? Or
no,
is it solid blue?
One of the early...
That's right.
Other
Sorry.
Than the Iowa caucuses.
It's the first in-person voting one as opposed to caucus.
Yeah.
So she had a wonderful experience doing that, and I joined her for the last 2 weeks of that, so I got a taste of it. So I did it on my own for Obama. She was the stay-at-home then, and that was very exciting. And for the last week, we went to Nevada, Las Vegas, before the election, and I worked as a poll watcher in a very poor neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
But we had a very nice hotel room, and so we watched the final returns come in.
That was a good year. Yeah.
Very exciting.
And Wesley Clark is now at UCLA.
Yeah.
He's at the Buerkle Center. Yeah. So it's not like he doesn't share his wisdom still and make a difference, right. But that campaign just kind of fizzled out.
Are you still active in Democratic politics?
I tried this year or early last year knocking on doors, but that lasted one day. And I figured that was for the primaries, I guess. And I didn't have the stamina, and I'm not a good enough talker. My wife is, her career was as a headhunter, and she would talk to people on the phone, and she has the gift of gab and engaging people, and she can pull things out of people that they never would have told anybody else, and I'm not that kind of person, so.
That's an important gift to have.
Yes.
But also California, I don't know how much door knocking and calling in California for a national election makes a difference.
I think California is pretty set.
Yeah, and it's electoral, so.
It did make a difference, I think, the grassroots organizing for Obama's first election.
Yeah, that was
it helped a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that was an exceptional election, but I mean, right now, you know, we know which way California is going to go.
All right, so we're getting the sign that we've got 5 minutes or less to go. So we can't let this go without talking more about the Palisades.
Yeah.
We know how you got into the position you're in. In your position, looking back as chairman for last, what, 6-8 months, something like that, and looking forward, what do you see are the biggest issues confronting the Palisades that you've had to deal with and that you anticipate dealing with?
Well, two of them are fire and power. We had planned to have a fire evacuation drill because the evacuation for the Getty and the Palisades fires were pretty miserable. I think for the Getty fire, the CHP blocked off southbound PCH just south of Temescal. So people evacuating from the Palisades were directed into the Malibu, into the path of the fire, and maybe clogging Topanga, which would have made that even worse if the fire had gotten close to there. So that's something that we'll have, and I'm working with Deputy Chief Fire Department Deputy Chief Hogan.
Yeah, we had a meeting in my house.
Yeah, you're on the committee.
And yes. I'm on it, and it was all set to go in June, and then the pandemic came.
Mm-hmm. And the other big issue is power. Mm-hmm. Right now we're about to have a huge heat spill over this weekend. And we've been warned that there might be power outages. We've had power outages before. It's only going to get worse. We just got notice this week that DWP is finally replacing the wooden power poles that supply power to the Palisades from the San Fernando Valley. There are only two ways that we get power. One is along a power line through Sunset, underground in Sunset, and from the east. And the other one is over the hill down through Temescal Canyon, from Mulholland down to Temescal. And that has wooden poles that were installed in the 30s through the 50s that are way past their useful life. And in high winds, they could spark fires if they fell down. If they shoot off sparks in a thunderstorm or a lightning storm, they could start fires. And so they have announced last year they started a replacement process for those, replacing them with steel poles. And I'm all for that personally. We're going to take this up at the next meeting on the 24th. We're going to get a presentation from DWP on this. The project halted because it was discovered there was an endangered species of a flowering plant in the path of this construction project. And so they're going to go before Coastal Commission in October to get Coastal's approval to do this and do the mitigation for that plant. And that's one thing. But really, a bigger picture is we need more power in general because we're building more condos, more apartments, more more people in bigger houses, more electric appliances of all sorts, more demands on electricity, and more construction, constant construction where the contractors plug in. And so we need to find a way that the community will accept more power. Is it going to be the pole-top power transformers like we see at the corner of Temescal and Sunset, and also at the Bernheimer Gardens at the end of Marquez Avenue? Or is it going to be a station like DWP had reserved at Marquez Elementary next door? Or is it going to be somewhere else or some other method of technology? And I think we need to revisit that. We haven't done that in like 3 or 4 years.
A little more.
I remember the big brouhaha over the siting next to Marquez Avenue School. And I have no preconceived notion or judgment as to what it should be or where it should go. But we need to revisit that because we need more power, period. A lot of people depend on... We're much more dependent now on our electronics than we ever were. Some people need electric supply for medical reasons. And as the earth gets warmer, my wife and I, about 3 years ago, finally installed air conditioning for the first time. Even though we're in Upper Marquez, we're at the edge of the fog belt. We didn't think we ever needed it, but it's gotten hotter and we're getting older. So we finally got it.
Yeah, and increasingly so, new construction in the Palisades is larger, and it definitely has electronic needs ranging, as you say, from air conditioning all the way down to serious electricity just for our regular electronics that we run our daily lives on.
Right.
Yeah, there's a meme going around on Facebook that says that the problem of the increasing temperatures is that we have too many thermometers. And if you if we had fewer thermometers, we would have much fewer days that were higher than 80 degrees.
That's just like testing for COVID.
If we had fewer testing.
Too much testing shows too much illness, and we just got to cut it back.
Exactly.
Yeah, that meme is going around. It's very funny. Lost on some, I'm sure, but it's very funny. Well, David, it was great to have you. Truly one of the best conversations we've had centered around the Palisades and beyond. I think we spun around the world with you. It was really quite a pleasure to have you here. It was a lovely conversation.
Well, have you guys been interviewed?
Miriam has. What happened was, we'll finish this up, but I originally started the Palisades podcast with my friend Brooke Daugherty, and I said to her, we came up with this idea. This was a few years ago. I said, first person I want to have is Miriam Czar. And she didn't know Miriam, but it turns out Miriam was on a trip somewhere. So our first guest was Bill Bruns, and Miriam was number two. And then after a while, a year or so ago, Brooke decided that she and her husband were going to retire and move out to the desert. And I said, what are we going to do? And she says, well, why don't you carry it on with Miriam? And that's what we've done. So
excellent.
There
and it's
isn't
been fun.
Someone our can first. Go back in our archives and listen to the Miriam Czar podcast.
But okay. I want to say our first interview was with an honorary Palisadian, and that was our introduction to this building. It was with Mike Bonin, and it was roughly a year ago. Who'd believe?
Yeah. This is, as you said, this is an incredible place, and I feel blessed to just be able to come in here once a month and look around.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure, Dave.
Truly a pleasure.
Thank you.
We look forward to having you again. Maybe at the end of your term, we can look back.
We'll see.